I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in a moment, we're going to go deeper into the first-of-its-kind study on eating disorders. What does it say about men? But first, that guerrilla marketing campaign gone awry here in Boston is raising questions about law enforcement, terrorism, and art. The city was brought to a halt yesterday after a transit worker reported a box with wires sticking out of it hanging from a highway ramp. The device turned out to be part of a marketing campaign, one of several signs made to look like a character from the Cartoon Network's late-night cult hit Aqua Teen Hunger Force. But before police figured that out, they'd shut down parts of the city for fear of a terrorist threat. And today, two young men were arraigned in court, charged with a recently enacted law making it a crime to perpetrate a hoax. Well, here now is Monica Brady Maroff, joins us in the studio with more. And tell us, first of all, who were these men who were arrested and what happened at their arraignment?
The two men were Peter Burdovsky and Sean Stevens. They're both from towns just outside Boston, both in their late 20s, self-employed. One is a computer programmer, one is a videographer. And they were apparently hired by the marketing firm Interference, Inc., to place these devices, and today they were charged with one count of placing a hoax device and one count of disorderly conduct. They were freed on bail of $2,500 after the arraignment. And after this, their lawyer, Mike Rich, was asked if the Cartoon Network or the defendants intended to scare people with this marketing ploy.
I don't think that anybody had any intent to raise fear, concern, or alarm, either by the design of the device or by the placement.
And Turner Broadcasting, which we should say, which owns the program, has issued an apology as well. Well, let's describe these for people who haven't been seeing them all day, as we were here in the Boston area, but it was on national television as well. These magnetic boxes were made from a game called Light Bright, light shining through it. They were made to look like characters from the cartoon, as we said, placed in nine other cities, New York, L.A., Philly, Portland, Oregon, and up in Boston for 2 weeks before anyone noticed. Now, Seattle officials said they found devices on Tuesday, and Public Works people there took them down without even calling police. So are there people saying Boston overreacted, and how are officials responding to that?
Well, the officials in Boston are saying, no, we didn't overreact. This is outrageous to post something like this in a post-9/11 world and not expect there to be a huge response. That comes from the mayor here, Tom Menino, who said he was not happy with this marketing scheme, and he's prepared to take any and all legal action against Turner Broadcasting. Also, the attorney general here said these boxes caused panic in the city, and there was no cause for that, and they also want to pursue legal action.
And we should paint that picture for people. I mean, the first device was found, and yet it was destroyed by a water gun at 10 in the morning?
Right. But when you looked at it, it had duct tape, it had wires coming out, it had batteries. Mm-hmm. As the prosecutor said today in court, all of the makings of a bomb. It looked like a bomb. And they were placed in locations that were at a bomb. It could have paralyzed transportation in the city.
And the next, people started calling in once they heard the reports, and so the next one, I think was all the calls started coming around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And we should describe further, this was a cartoon character, but if you looked closely, he was, what is the delicate way of saying this?
Well, as they said in court today to the judge, he was flipping the bird.
Yes. And so some, you know, police thought that was another indication that this was not as innocent as
right.
It appeared.
That it could be a terrorist act. And all the police and the fire, there were so many sirens throughout the city over this. And the mayor says it cost $750,000 in police response. And he wants Turner Broadcasting to pay for that.
On the other hand, there are some, I understand there were some protesters there today who are worried about art, graffiti and art and this kind of guerrilla advertising. What were they saying?
They said this is a huge overreaction, that people just need to use their heads and determine whether something is art or marketing or is truly dangerous, and that these two men who put these devices up are just scapegoats, and they're worried that they're just going to be held responsible for this when they were just, you know, hired for a job, freelance basis, and the society's gotten so concerned about terrorism that it's really overreacted.
The Boston Globe quotes a blogger who wrote, "Repeat after me, authorities. LED, not IED. LED meaning light-emitting diodes, and IED, of course, being improvised explosive devices. But yesterday in Boston, they looked a lot alike. Very quickly, the Homeland Security Agency did not raise the threat alert?
No, they alerted other cities to these suspicious devices. But as we said, by 10 a.m., they determined that the first device was not harmful, and they did not raise the level. Now, I don't know what, maybe that's because we're getting a little more cautious in our days. If you recall, after 9/11, the alert was going up and down like a yo-yo. They seem to take a more cautious approach with this.
Here now is Monica Brady Maroff reporting on the guerrilla marketing campaign that was taken for a possible terrorist threat here in Boston yesterday. City still recovering. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, for many of you, this is mealtime, so we want to give you a heads up that we want to spend some time now on the implications of the first ever national study on eating disorders. It was released today, and in parts, it does not paint a pretty picture. But the results are also interesting because anorexia and bulimia do get the most press in the world in general. But if you think of the recent spate of stories of fashion models starving themselves to death, that underscores that point. But this new study shows that frequent and uncontrollable binge eating is actually the most common eating disorder in the U.S., and the study counters the impression that eating disorders only affect women. The lead author of the study is Dr. James Hudson, director of the Psychiatric Epidemiology Research Program at McLean Hospital here in Belmont, Massachusetts. He's also professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Hudson, welcome.
Welcome.
And we're also joined by Dr. Cynthia Bulick. She was not involved in this study, but she is an expert in the area and a colleague of Dr. Hudson's. Dr. Bulick is director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Dr. Bulick, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Hudson, let's start with you, and let's start with binge eating, because, you know, of course, people are talking about this today. And when you're speaking of binge eating, they might be wondering, what do you mean? I mean, I might be revealing too much, but, you know, who hasn't absentmindedly eaten half a box of Wheat Thins? You know, so how did you define binge eating when you asked people if they did it?
Well, we were trying to assess binge eating disorder, which is a condition where people have recurrent, twice weekly or more, episodes of binge eating. Now, a binge is eating a large amount of food in a short period of time associated with a loss of control over one's eating.
So, in other words, when you're doing this twice a week, you sort of know you're out of control?
Well, people can recognize this as not their normal eating pattern, and they have a distinct sense that they just can't control the eating during the binges, that once they've started, they can't stop. They'll eat until they're uncomfortably full. They'll eat when they're not even physically hungry. They'll eat to the point where afterwards they feel depressed or disgusted with themselves afterwards. So this is just not a normal eating pattern.
And Dr. Bulick, why don't you jump in with more anecdotes about this? Because again, is this, you know, eating in secret? I mean, tell us more about binge eating, because, you know, Super Bowl weekend's coming up, for instance, and people are thinking, oh, is that me, you know, when I put away two buckets of chicken wings? But, you know, tell us more about what really defines a binge eater.
Well, sure. I think what Jim was saying is right on, and that dividing line really is the sense of feeling out of control and the distress associated with it. So people who binge eat feel distressed after they have these episodes. In addition to feeling out of control during the binge, some people feel that they have no control over the urge to binge. So they might see a high-risk food, and they just can't put the brakes on. They go straight for that binge eating episode.
And we know that it's lunchtime in some areas listening to us, and so, we want to have said this is a touchy subject for many people. But, Dr. Hudson, you are not talking about people who are purging, who are eating so much and then making themselves be sick?
That's right. People who have binge eating episodes and then follow them with purging, such as self-induced vomiting, have bulimia nervosa, sort of the binge purge syndrome, and that's familiar with to most people. Mm. But what this is the compulsive binge eating, but without any compensatory behavior. And so perhaps as a consequence of this, but we know about binge eating disorders, it's strongly associated with obesity and associated with a striking degree of weight gain.
Right. And Dr. Bulick, just help us finish this description. You know, I know it probably varies person to person, but how much food? I mean, an extra serving at dinner or standing up at the fridge at 3 in the morning and eating everything in it? I mean, what are you talking about?
Well, that's something we don't have an actual number of calories to define a binge, so we usually think about it in terms of social comparison. So is it more food than a normal healthy person would eat under some similar circumstances? So we're not talking about the Super Bowl, and we're not talking about Thanksgiving, but we are talking about an unusually large amount of food in situations where that really isn't typical or healthy. It can be a bag of chips. It can be a bag of chips followed by a roll of cookies. It can be 4 different types of servings at 4 different fast food restaurants in a row. It can be trolling through the food court in the mall and stopping at several different stalls and getting food. Yeah. And often you see this switch back and forth between sweet and salty just to really satisfy all the cravings that are driving the binge.
Yeah. Is it, Dr. Hudson, by the way, is it like alcoholism, that kind of uncontrollable, you know, just once you start, you can't stop?
Yes, there's certainly a great deal of similarity between binge drinking, say, and binge eating. The individual who's susceptible to binge drinking, once they start with alcohol, they just can't stop. And that's the same experience that people describe to us when they're having binge eating episodes. In fact, all of us have seen individuals who come to us and have said, well, I've had a problem with alcohol in the past, but now it's the same thing, only with food.
Huh. And what does that tell you? And by the way, I understand that binge eating right now doesn't have an official psychiatric diagnosis. So what is your research telling you about binge eating?
What we found was that binge eating disorder was more common than anorexia or bulimia nervosa combined. It was associated with obesity, particularly severe obesity, and thereby all of its complications, and also was a quite chronic and persistent condition. So taken together, these findings, combined with those in other studies that have come out, suggest that binge eating disorder is a true disorder.
In fact, Dr. Hudson, I'm reading that you're hoping that your findings will give additional support for including the diagnosis of binge eating disorder as an official psychiatric diagnosis in the American Psychiatric Association's manual. Dr. Bulick, your thoughts?
I think we need to look at all of this and the results of this great study in the context of the obesity epidemic, because what we know now is obesity is on the rise, and there are many different pathways to the end point of being obese. And I think what Jim and his colleagues' study are showing us is that binge eating is one of those modifiable behavioral factors that can lead down the pathway to obesity. And basically what we're saying is, how can we treat people who are obese? And this tells us that binge eating is one of those key behaviors that we might be able to change as one way of going about combating the obesity epidemic.
And what do you make of the fact that more men than previously thought are binge eating? I mean, again, if it is perhaps like alcoholism, maybe there are other factors, genetic factors, who knows, but if it's an emotional issue, why do you think that is? I mean, do you think men are more conscious of their image now than before?
Well, I don't go with the fact that it's just an emotional issue. I think emotions play a role, but I think we know that genes play a role in binge eating disorder. And genes play a role for both men and women. And what we're really looking at is the convergence of genetic and environmental factors here. So people have an underlying genetic risk, but we are surrounded by high-risk food cues, and that's both for men and women. And that might be releasing some of the underlying genetic risk that both women and men share.
What do you mean by the food cues? Just what it sounds like, the food courts and things we were talking about?
The food courts, the abundance of food, the high sugar content, all of those things are just bombarding people, especially those people who are at higher genetic risk.
That's Dr. Cynthia Bulick. She's director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. We're also speaking with Dr. James Hudson, co-author of the new study on eating disorders. When we come back, what that supermodel Giselle said and why it matters in the context of this discussion, that's ahead here and now. Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Dr. James Hudson, director of the Psychiatric Epidemiology Research Program at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts, also lead author of the new National Eating Disorder Study. We're also joined by Dr. Cynthia Bulick, who's director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And we want to turn this subject now to anorexia. Recently, international models who starve themselves to death have been in the headlines, and there are calls for standards, body mass standards, for the industry to prevent that from happening. On the other hand, model Tyra Banks gained weight, and the tabloids called her fat. But then there's a supermodel Giselle Bundchen. In one report, she said she's never had an easy eating disorder because she's had a strong family base. First of all, Dr. Bulick, is that ever true that people who have, you know, learned better eating habits, they sit down to balanced meals, or maybe have a stronger sense of self because of a stable family, and they're not going to have eating disorders?
I have real concerns with Giselle Bundchen's comment about families cause eating disorder, because that just goes along with bad stigma and bad press that this disorder has gotten forever. Families do not cause eating disorders. In fact, they're our best advocates in treating eating disorders. And in fact, I heard she did a retraction of that statement sort of in the Brazilian version of People magazine today. So especially with anorexia nervosa, we need to look at those underlying genetic components that lead to risk for anorexia nervosa and stop blaming families. They've been stigmatized for way too long as causing these disorders.
If they don't cause them, can they help prevent them? As you said, by being vigilant, by seeing something, is there something they can do by teaching children earlier about food so that at least there's some awareness, or is there just no way to prevent it?
I think families are really our best weapon in treating eating disorders, and we work with parents all the time to help them identify what unhealthy eating behaviors and body image looks like so that they can get their kids in for an evaluation earlier rather than waiting until it's too late.
Well, Dr. James Hudson, I want to bring you back in again with the results of your study, because I thought it was interesting when you did a timeline how long anorexia nervosa lasts compared to, you know, other eating disorders. Could you give us some of those numbers?
We found that bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder lasted for an average of about 8 years, whereas with anorexia nervosa, it was only an average of 1.7 years. That was surprising to us because we all knew, or thought we knew, that anorexia nervosa invariably was a chronic and persistent condition. Mm. But with these findings tell us is that those impressions were incorrect, that those had all been based on studies that had looked at people who came in for treatment. But for every one of those, there appear to be others in the community who are able to get through their illness and recover much more quickly.
That's good news.
Yes, that's good news, because it means that anorexia nervosa isn't necessarily going to be chronic and severe.
Or fatal.
Right. Now, clearly, I don't mean to suggest that it's a small problem. It's one of the most devastating mental disorders that we have, has the highest mortality rate. But there is hope. There are others who are able to recover rather quickly from their condition and be very useful in the future if we could examine those individuals and see what factors might allow them to recover quickly and thereby maybe help prevent others from developing long-term cases.
Dr. Hudson, it doesn't seem in the part of the study that I'm reading that you studied children directly, but does your study tell you something about children and eating habits?
We interviewed adults 18 and older, but we also were asking them questions about when they started having problems with their eating and that sort of thing. And the striking findings there were that, say, with binge eating disorder, the onset of the condition was often in childhood, even before the age of 10 or 11, so that we'd have people who, almost from earliest time they can remember, felt that their eating was out of control.
Well, and Dr. Bulick, what do we learn from that? Because I want to tick off some of the things that are popping up in the news, stories that have to do with children and obesity. We hear reports of some schools sending home notices with report cards that children are too overweight. Here in the Boston area, a hospital is running a campaign against childhood obesity, and they had put up some outdoor advertising, and they pulled one down because it showed a child with rolls of fat and just felt that it was humiliating. People seem to be grappling with, as you said, the family may be the first line of defense, but on the other hand, you don't want to blame them and you don't want to scare kids. So given this information that it starts in childhood, how should we approach it?
I think this is one of those critical times where the obesity people and the eating disorders people need to work together, because people are so desperate to prevent obesity in children. They're trying all sorts of things. But what we don't want is we don't want our preventive efforts for obesity to cause more eating disorders.
And so how do you mean? In other words, if someone is upset about how they're looking, they might eat more?
No, we don't want to encourage children to engage in unhealthy dieting practices in order to lose weight. We want to make sure that we're bringing both sides to the middle, because really that middle message of moderation can go a long way toward preventing both obesity and eating disorders.
Dr. Hudson, we just have about a minute left. We've talked about how you've discovered that more men had eating disorders than previously thought, that binging was far more prevalent than starving oneself. Oneself to death. What else jumped out at you from your study?
Well, we found that eating disorders of all kinds have been increasing steadily in prevalence over the latter part of the 20th century. We also found that all of the eating disorders were strongly associated with other mental disorders, including mood disorders, anxiety disorders, substance use disorders, and impulse control disorders.
And Dr. Bulick, if somebody's self-identifying now and they're thinking, you know what, those trips at 2 in the morning to the refrigerator, it's not funny. Who do they call first? What kind of specialist? Who do you go to? How do you start?
Best thing to do is to call your nearest university medical center and see if they have an eating disorders program and get yourself in for a comprehensive evaluation because effective treatments are available.
That's Dr. Cynthia Bulick. She's director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And we've also been speaking with Dr. James Hudson, lead author of what's being called the first ever national study of eating disorders. He's director of the Psychiatric Epidemiology Research Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. He's also professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. I want to thank you both for sharing your knowledge with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And by the way, that study is published today in the Journal of Biological Psychiatry. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, we move ahead, and still ahead, another biographer tries to tell the mysterious tale of the late Nick Drake. You're listening to Here Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hugo Chavez, the newly reelected socialist president of oil-rich Venezuela, is forging ahead with what he's calling his maximum revolution. In a show of hands yesterday in Caracas, lawmakers in the National Assembly, which is entirely loyal to Chavez, unanimously approved a measure giving him the ability to rule by decree for the next year and a half. Chavez has already promised to nationalize Venezuelan telecommunications and electricity and impose greater state control over its oil and natural gas industries. Latin American expert Shannon O'Neill joins us now from a studio at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, where she is an adjunct fellow. And Shannon, tell us straight out, do these new powers make Chavez a dictator?
Well, these powers do give him enormous influence over decisions going forward, but the Congress did approve this law, so this was supported by the legislature, and we have to remember, just 2 months ago, he was elected with over 60% of the vote in an election that international observers called free and fair. So what this really shows is the weakness of Venezuela's political institutions.
Well, I was going to say, remind us first, why all the lawmakers in the National Assembly are his supporters, as well as the judiciary?
Sure. Well, particularly in the Congress, in 2005, they held congressional elections, and the opposition parties decided to boycott that election. And so that didn't delegitimize the system, but what it did mean is that all the people who were elected were Chavez supporters. So 100% are his supporters.
But he does have opponents, but it sounds like the Sunnis staying out of the election in Iraq, leading to a Shia parliament initially. Well, tell us how this would work. First of all, how would his greater control of oil and gas industries work? Because we know that multinational companies like ExxonMobil are there. By the way, ExxonMobil posting the largest annual profit by a U.S. company, I think $39.5 billion, topping its previous record. So what does it mean for multinational companies that he wants to perhaps nationalize them?
It's really unclear at this point, and it looks like, particularly in the oil industry, that what Chavez is trying to do is form public-private partnerships, but where the public government, the Venezuelan government, actually controls the joint venture, but keeps Exxon and the other companies as private members, because Chavez really needs their investment and their expertise to take these projects forward.
Well, and what is Chavez, you know, doing with this power? What would he, for instance, would he do with monies that the state Venezuela might take from private companies?
Well, he has been pushing forward in the last years a large set of social programs. These include things like building healthcare clinics, bringing doctors to neighborhoods that haven't had them, building new schools, building subsidized housing, providing food subsidies, all sorts of programs for the poorer sectors of the population. He'll continue these and likely expand them.
Okay. Well, we mentioned that Chavez does have his opponents. Are they free to criticize him?
Well, you know, they have been free to criticize them up till now, and they have done that through the media as well as through other outlets. I mean, there have been some questions recently, particularly he revoked the license of one of the main TV stations that was in opposition to him. There's questions about how much freedom they'll have going forward, but that's still a bit unclear.
Well, we want to remind ourselves there's no love lost between Presidents Bush and Chavez. I remember at the UN, President Chavez called President Bush an imperialist devil. President Bush has said he's concerned about the new powers of Chavez. But then we're thinking also of Monday's New York Times report saying that President Bush is using executive orders to enforce policy in federal agencies. Can Chavez claim that he's doing the same thing, or is there a difference?
Well, Chavez is claiming that he's doing the same thing, or many of his ministers are saying that what he's doing is really no different. And in fact, the Venezuelan Congress has approved what he's doing, and there's questions, he would say, in our government whether our Congress has approved that.
But critics of Chavez, I'm sure, could rush to point out that is the major difference, that the ministries and agencies and the judiciary and lawmakers in the U.S. are stronger than they
right.
are. Yeah.
Right, and that is true.
Yeah. So bottom line, has Chavez's move put him in danger on the world stage or in Latin America, or perhaps positioned him more positively?
Well, as long as he has oil revenues, he'll be able to do pretty much what he wants in Venezuela. But we are seeing many of the other Latin American governments, particularly of the larger countries, turning away from the economic model that he is implementing. And we just saw 2 weeks ago there was a Mercosur trade summit. So all the leaders of the main South American countries came together. And there were actually open disagreements between Chavez and the heads of Brazil, Colombia, even Argentina, over the direction of the economy that he's trying to take it in.
And we want to point out here in the U.S. this week, the likely second-in-command at the State Department, John Negroponte, said Chavez was exporting a form of radical populism that threatens democracy. Shannon O'Neill, Adjunct Fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. Thanks so much for coloring it in for us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, quick note for you, we've been monitoring today the Senate confirmation hearing of General George Casey, who's leaving his job as the commanding general in Iraq to become the next chief of staff for the Army. This morning, members of the Armed Services Committee pressed General Casey on U.S. failures in Iraq and the president's new plan to send 21,000 more troops to Iraq. Casey said he believes the president's plan can work and the struggle in Iraq is winnable, but Senator John McCain, a Republican presidential hopeful and supporter of additional troops in Iraq, said he has strong reservations about Casey becoming the next Army chief because the situation in Iraq has gotten markedly and progressively worse under Casey's command. Here's an exchange from the hearing, starting with Senator McCain.
In recent days, the Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Abizaid's designated successor, Admiral Fallon, have all stated we're not winning and we had a failed strategy. Now, those are clear-cut statements for the record. Do you agree with that?
Do I agree
assessment?
That we have a failed strategy?
We had a failed
strategy.
Policy, and we are not winning.
Senator, I do not agree that we have a failed policy. I believe the president's new strategy will enhance the policy that we have.
So you view this change in strategy as just as an enhancement of the previous policy?
Well, it's a significant shift. But I believe it will be an enhancement over the current policy. But I don't – the policy of training and equipping Iraqi security forces and gradually passing security responsibility to them as they are ready is still an important element of the current strategy. And
so,
it's part of the Amman Agreement.
So you disagree with the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Admiral Fallon that we had a failed policy?
I do, Senator. I do not believe that the current policy has failed.
Well, Republican John Warner, one of the senators drafting a resolution critical of the president's strategy, asked General Casey whether he'd felt free to question military orders handed down by the president and his advisors. General Casey responded that he did, that there was a, quote, strong dialogue on decisions, and that he believed in the policies he was implementing and would have taken action if he didn't. Still to come today, mental illness and magical music, they mix in his music and in a new book that unveils the shadowy character of singer-songwriter Nick Drake. That's still to come. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this weekend will at least put an end to 2 weeks of hype and hysteria. Super Bowl 41, or XL1, will finally take place. The Indianapolis Colts will meet the Chicago Bears on Sunday in Miami. And here to talk about the game and his own Super Bowl traditions, all the little knickknacks and whatnots he puts around.
Knickknacks?
Only a game host, Bill Little Phil. Hi, Bill.
Knickknacks?
I know you get out your bobbleheads.
This is the Super Bowl.
Okay. Well, you know, even non-football fans, you know, tune in. But will it be a good game?
Oh, anybody's guess, Robin. Sometimes the Super Bowl is a good game, and sometimes the people who paid all that money for commercials on TV are tearing their hair up because everybody stopped watching at halftime because it's 41-6.
Right.
That so, I hate those years. It can go either way.
Hate those years when that happens. Well, we know some of the powerful stories surrounding the games are the fact that both the Colts' Tony Dungy and the Bears' Lovie Smith are African-American. The question of whether or not Colts quarterback Peyton Manning will finally win, the big one, you know, for him. But is there a story out of the media week that you like?
Well, it's not so much a story that I like, but it's a story that I think characterizes not only the Super Bowl, but maybe the whole professional sports landscape so well, which is the story of Tank Johnson, the Chicago defensive tackle, been arrested 3 times for possession of weapons, 500 rounds of ammunition in his house. The last time the police went in, he had to get special dispensation from a judge to make the trip. He was under house arrest, and of course he did because he's an important player in the Super Bowl, and so the judge understood that. This is the sort of thing that gets people talking about the kind of crazy place that that sports have assumed in our culture.
About 10 listeners have emailed me the joke, and this will be the last comment on the Patriots who did not make it in, and yet the Indianapolis Colts have our kicker, Adam Vinatieri, who of course was traded. Let's see, somebody dies, some fan dies and goes to heaven, and they see this house all decorated with Tom Brady paraphernalia and Patriots, you know, banners and everything, and they say, hey, how come Peyton Manning has that house? And they say, that's not Peyton Manning's house. No, wait, how come Tom Brady has, you know, that big special house? And they say, that's not Tom Brady's house, that's God's house. I got about 10 listeners, so, you know, Patriots fans persevere.
Absolutely.
But Boston sports fans have very little to cheer about. Patriots eliminated, Bruins struggling. Last night, the Boston Celtics lost their 13th straight game to the visiting Lakers, matching their team record. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that they just should keep going on that streak, and that way they have a pretty good shot at the lottery pick, and they get Greg Odom, who's about 9 feet tall, and if anybody can turn the Celtics around, he can, coming from Ohio State, or maybe they get Kevin Durant from Texas, and, you know, those two are the kind of players who turn bad teams into good teams overnight.
Okay. And a last note, just since we're just doing a little Boston wrap-up, because here we are, and people seem to care about the marriage of Red Sox general manager Theo Epstein. What was the deal with this and the mystery around it?
Well,
across the country they were talking about.
Well, his dad, novelist Leslie Epstein and head of the creative writing program here at Boston University, thought it would be funny to opine that his son had gotten married at Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Stand in Coney Island. Which, so far as I know, and Professor Epstein knows, Theo has never even visited. But it made a great story. And, of course, people took it seriously and wrote that he'd been married at a hot dog stand. And it really didn't happen that way.
Okay. Returning to the Super Bowl, you have a tradition. We just love it, only a game. The Super Bowl haiku,
mm-hmm.
Japanese poetry, 17-syllable odes to the game. May we hear just a preview?
Well, the only thing that our Super Bowl haiku really has in common with real haiku is the number of syllables. I refuse to entertain the notion that this is really haiku, but I'll give you a couple just for the fun of it. How about this?
Good.
Limping man, joints sprung, hobbles to trainer's table. Make it go once more.
Oh, that...
It's hair on the back of your neck?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Can we have another?
One more? Just,
mm-hmm.
You know,
please.
Sort of an economic haiku here.
Go.
High in the cheap seats. Wait, today, high is redundant, and there's no cheap seat.
Ah.
Ah, exactly. Oh, my gosh, it must have been a haiku. She went, ah.
Our poet from the world of sports, Bill Littlefield, his show, Only a Game, and Super Bowl haiku, and a lot more this weekend. Do not miss it. Bill, thanks as always.
All right, Robin, thank you.
Stay with us. Ah. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Nick Drake had already been dead for 26 years when he had his first hit song, showcased on a Volkswagen commercial.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way.
Pink Moon sparked a revival for the painfully shy British songwriter Nick Drake, who sank into mental illness, either caused by or masked by drug use, and produced only three albums before dying in 1974 at the age of 26, possibly from a drug-induced suicide. New CD reissues, documentary films, and articles have put Nick Drake back in the public eye. Author Trevor Dann is a longtime fan and former head of BBC Music Entertainment. His new book, Darker Than the Deepest Sea, The Search for Nick Drake, traces the steps of the tall, lanky, increasingly shadowy figure before he disappears from view. And Trevor joins us now. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, you know, it was so interesting to read this because Nick Drake left so little on the record. He played few live shows. He gave just one interview to the British press. So you talked to his school friends, his remaining sister, other musicians. Give us the outline of who Nick Drake is and how they started to color it in for you.
Do you know, he's the anti-pop star, because most pop stars make it very quickly and then spend a long time unknown. And Nick Drake has spent a long time unknown and then become very successful long after his death.
Right.
He was a shadowy figure in his own life, and as such was quite interesting to research, because people who knew him in one area of his life didn't know his other friends. When he died and a few people got together for his funeral, many of them didn't know that each other were friends of his. He was a guy who compartmentalized his life, kept people away from each other and away from him.
Your title is Darker Than the Deepest Sea. It's a lyric that you take from his song, Place to Be. Let's listen.
And I was green, greener. Where flowers grow and the sun shines still. Now I'm darker than the deepest sea. Just hand me down, give me a place to be.
One of the descriptions of Nick's songs in the book comes from Robin Hitchcock, the rock and roller, who described Nick Drake's songs like butterflies attached to anchors.
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah, it really was. What were the anchors?
I think what Robin is getting at is that there's some really deep, primal stuff going on in Nick's lyrics, although the sound of them is a sort of filigree butterfly floating sort of noise. And I think it's the contrast between the deep and the flowing that makes them so beautiful.
Well, you know, he was despondent that he didn't become a star faster. Musicians seemed to love him. So what was it? I mean, if you had to sum it up, having written the whole book, what happened? How come he didn't become a star sooner?
I think he was very badly damaged by a lot of bad luck in marketing. You know, his records, each one of them came out when there was a postal strike or when, for some reason, the marketing didn't work. But also, of course, he didn't promote them. He wouldn't go out. He was too shy. He played half a dozen gigs in his life and was no good at it. And that hurt him very deeply. This is in the days when albums came out and nobody promoted the singles. So not enough people quite simply heard it. And he that made him very cross.
Well, Drake was recognized and loved by other musicians. Here's the song Fly that Drake recorded with John Cale of the Velvet Underground on viola and harpsichord.
Please tell me your second name. Please play me your second game. I've fallen so far for the people you just need your star for a day.
You have a theory about what happened to Nick Drake. He smoked, as you write, industrial quantities of cannabis. These huge amounts of marijuana might have, what, provoked a psychosis?
I found out that prolonged exposure to that amount of cannabis has been proved over several years now that it can produce an effect that is virtually schizophrenia.
Well, we should say we did some research ourselves, and it's there have been recent reports saying that this huge amount of cannabis may, in fact, provoke mental illnesses. Others say it's hooey. Either way, as you said, it's so sad because nobody caught it.
No, and, you know, during this period, not many people liked him. You know, he was a bit of a spoilt rich kid by this point, and the world owed him a living, and it wasn't giving him a living. He didn't wash, he didn't cut his fingernails, he turned into a kind of Howard Hughes. He was not a lot of fun to be with. And when it was announced that he died in his record company, Island Records, several people stood up and cheered because he'd been such a damn nuisance when they were trying to promote him and make him famous. So, you know, this is not a story of a beautiful boy who, you know, who was badly treated by the world. You know, he did bring a lot of this on himself.
It's funny because that is part of the mythology, that he was just too fragile for this world.
Yeah. You know, if you get on the old websites and you find all these mad Draco files who are now all over the world, you know, the view is, well, he's an angel. I don't buy that. I think he made some simply gorgeous records, but I don't buy the idea that he was the son of God.
On the other hand, is there somewhere down the middle where maybe he wasn't just an arrogant rich kid who self-destructed, but maybe he was a very fragile young man wrestling with mental illness, and, you know, more true than the fact that he was angelic, but equally sad.
It's a tragic tale because, you know, like all good tragedies, it is, you know, the roots of his destruction are in himself. But none of this should take away from the fact that he wrote some words and put them together with some melodies which have proved to be completely timeless. That's a tremendous accolade and a great thing to say about any artist.
Well, Nick Drake spent his last night at his parents' home reading Camus' Myth of Sisyphus, listening to Bach's Brandenburg Concerto, and throwing back sleeping pills. Too many, it turns out. Do you think he killed himself?
I think the chances are that he did. I think his sister always says that he probably just did it to see. I think he was at the end of his tether. My best guess is that it's a mixture of I can't go on with this, but also I think he may simply have taken too many. These were antidepressants more than sleeping pills, and they'd been given to him in a different dose. He was used to taking smaller tablets. They gave him bigger ones. He took as many of those as he should have done of the other ones. So I think it's probably a mixture. And, you know, in a way, that all adds to the myth. It all adds, you know, I think one of the interesting things about the book is you can make your own mind up. And when people review it and say, well, he never says really whether he committed suicide or not, I always say, well, you know, it's a bit like a novel, you decide.
Trevor Dan, author of Darker Than the Deepest Sea, The Search for Nick Drake. You'll find more on the book and the link to Trevor's blog at our website, here-now.org. And we'll listen to more of the music as we say thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me on.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.